So, welcome, Patricia. Hope.
Morning. How are you?
Good. 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 Thank you very much. And Hope is also producer. She's a programmer, actually, on Tuesday Morning Breakfast, and very familiar with our setup here. So, okay. Now, you went to the rally last Sunday, Black Lives Matter, I hope.
Yes, I did. It was just a gathering to show solidarity with African-American people in the U.S. After the killings, the murders of two men, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. But I guess it goes deeper than that, because I guess their recent murders, I think, was the last straw. But of course, things are continuing. And, you know, you saw that story. I can't remember his name, but there's been another man who was shot who was trying to help a man with autism, and he was shot, and there's new video evidence of that. So I guess it's been a long time coming, and the Black Lives Matter movement has been going on for some years now, but I think those two cases of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling really tipped everything over, and so you know, the rally was there to highlight our solidarity with African American people, but also to highlight what Aboriginal Australians go through here in Australia, and to also to highlight what African Australians go through here in Australia, because racism is very much alive and well, as you're saying.
Yes.
And you know, things in terms of police brutality, of course, we're lucky here in Australia that it doesn't happen on the scale that it does in the US, but people should remember that it does happen here. When you look at Aboriginal deaths in custody, it happens in other ways, it manifests in other ways. When you look at profiling of black people, and it happens in other ways, you know, institutionally, in terms of black people not receiving the same amount of consideration when it comes to jobs, when it comes to housing. So it manifests itself in other ways, but I guess we should be lucky that we don't have as many guns.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's easily available to just fire off when you feel, you know, bad about something or other. But one of the things I wanted to explore was the connection between racism as a phenomena and the political system or political economic system. You know, we talk about how capitalism is linked to racism, or how capitalism uses racism in the process of dividing people, so they're too busy worrying about these divisions as opposed to actually countering the broader political system. I just wondered what you thought about that, because you've got, you know, a lot of experience around the world. You've been to Mexico. You certainly have first-hand knowledge in South Africa. So how does that sit with you?
Well, yeah, I mean, the links between capitalism and racism, or even classism, for capitalism to function, I guess there has to be a working class, or like or even a slave class is how I see it, to be honest. For the 1% to keep getting richer. I mean, everything that we have is built on colonialization. It's built off of you know, the enslavement and free labor of people for centuries, and everywhere you see this. So of course in America there's slavery, you know, there's a history of slavery. In South Africa, I guess it's the apartheid system and colonization, and in Australia, of course, colonization. But now, since you know, countries have said, okay, you know, we've gotten rid of slavery or that sort of thing, even though officially that's the case, we still have all of those structures in place, or all of those, you know, institutionalized racism and white supremacy is still very much in place when you look at who owns, you know, the majority of companies and where these companies are operating. So I'm really interested as well in terms of the role that capitalism plays in the African context. So in South Africa, you know, even though we've gotten rid of apartheid, dismantled apartheid, and it's mostly, you know, black government that's in power, police brutality is still there. You still see this in, you know, in the mine strikes at Marikana, in the murder
That's right.
of environmental activists. And you still see this white supremacy manifested in different ways, because those mines and those companies, one of those companies where the environmentalist was murdered is an Australian-owned company. And then you also see this, you know, there's a new sort of the influence of China that's coming in now. So China in Zimbabwe and China in other African countries sort of dismissing some of that debt but bringing in their own workers, so that workers within those African countries, so in South Sudan and in Zimbabwe and in Mozambique, though people who are living there don't have the opportunity to work or get jobs, because China's kind of come in with a sweet deal for the governments, and then the governments have allowed them to sort of come in and dictate their own terms, further meaning that that local people don't have the opportunity for employment and that sort of thing. So you see all of this manifested in various ways, and it was born out of colonialism, and there's elements of racism, but capitalism is there to kind of keep to keep people separate in terms of class. And it's there. So in terms of Australia, just even what was revealed in terms of the government, the visas. So people who are working offshore getting certain visa exemptions, and the parallels people have made, just kind of looking at how we treat asylum seekers, people who are seeking asylum, but then of course all these exemptions being there for offshore workers. Mm. So of course, whenever money is involved or capital is involved, you know, people, it's fine, you're good to go. It doesn't matter what skin color or
That's
race
right.
you are. But when human rights are involved, then you see all these things, you know, manifest. You're not good enough because of the color of your skin. You're not good enough because you don't speak good English. And in this, I acknowledge my own privilege. You know, even though I'm black, you know, my status is better because of the education that I've had. You know, I'm sort of the model migrant, if you will.
Yeah.
But for other people who've kind of come here in different ways, they really do struggle because of language, because they can't advocate for themselves. And that sort of thing.
Yeah,
but
it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing how widely prevalent and influences racism has across the board in many ways. Now, Jacob's here, and he wanted to ask you a question.
Yeah, my question is, you sort of gone, you know, of you know, the problems of racism, you know, and how it's sort of linked to, you know, capitalism. And I kind of wanted to hear your perspective, you know, how can we kind of defeat, you know, racism, you know, in society, like, you know, in terms of like tactics, strategy, and what needs to be kind of done?
Learning and immersion, to be honest. You know, if you don't know anything about a culture, like, you know, just get a wide variety of friends, I think is the main thing. And the more that people can sort of undo that fear that has been created by governments, that has been created by, you know, even people like Sonia Kruger. A lot of it is fear-mongering. A lot of it is, you know, and this is simplistic, the way that I'm putting it, but that is also the first step. It's like, oh, hang on, I've got a Muslim. If Sonia Kruger really had a Muslim friend or knew anything about Islam, I bet you she wouldn't be saying most of those things. Probably the way that she interacts with these people is probably like, oh, yes, I bumped into Walid Ali and his wife once, and we both drank, you know, water or something. But you know, you've got to go out and, yeah, eat the food. You've got to volunteer. Volunteering is also a very good way to keep in touch with people who are not like yourself. But these days, you know, we're distracted. And this is what governments want. They want to distract us with, I don't know, Pokemon Go. They want to distract us with things that they're playing on our fears. So we have to find a way to dismantle these fears and be like, you know, am I really in danger? You know, what is life really like for people who are not the same as myself? And that is the first step. It's immersion and getting to know each other. And then you can build from there, you know, build your own thoughts from there.
Yeah, it's a cliche, isn't it? I'm not racist, but or I have Muslim friends, I have black friends, and that qualifies them to be experts in the topic of racism. It always amuses me when they say that. I immediately switch off. Right, here we go. You know, it's a very stereotypical way of intervening for lots of people. the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, you work with a lot of people in your everyday line. How do you find racism manifesting in your work, if anything at all? Because that's one of the areas that we have big issues with as migrants. I remember one survey they did or research they did that a migrant has to try like 65 times more compared to a Anglo person applying for a job, which I thought was incredible figures. So do you come across any of that manifestation at work?
Yes. Well, I guess I work in I'm responsible for working with migrants and refugees. So in that, you know, people are looking for a brown face already. So in some ways, you know, I'm at an advantage because they're like, okay, you're a brown person, you're here to work with the other brown people.
Yes.
But that in itself, you know, can be inherently racist because then you've just kind of become the token person to work with all these other token people.
That's right.
So it works to my advantage and to my disadvantage. So in some ways, I feel very comfortable in that sector because I'm called upon to work in multicultural issues. But on the flip side of that, I guess, and this is where I really love Aboriginal community-controlled organizations, on the flip side of that, the messages get diluted, then you're just kind of going out to work with all sorts of migrants and refugees, and people don't really pay attention to the differences in your own culture and the culture of other people. So clumping multiculturalism into one kind of can also leave some voices out and can leave some important conversations out around classism and colorism within our own communities, because we don't get to control the narratives, whereas I really love Aboriginal community-controlled organizations because they can control and organize themselves, and so they should, and discuss everything from that political lens and discuss things from the lens of, you know, wanting a change in the form of a treaty. On the flip side, when not in my sector, you know, racism is very much alive and well. You know, only now people have started talking about diversity. But when I first started working, you know, it was really hard to get a job. It was really hard to, you know, you couldn't quite figure out what went wrong in interviews or why you didn't get called back. I'm really lucky because, you know, my first name, the name my parents gave me, Hope. You know, sometimes people find it upbeat and wanna find out more. But if everything was impronounceable, then I don't really know where I would be. Similar to, you know, I've heard these stories from a lot of people who are my friends, who've got more complicated names to pronounce. So it's really interesting.
Okay. On that note, thank you very much for being available this time of the morning.
Yeah.
To talk to us about this subject in a broader way, because that rally on Sunday was epitome of the frustration felt by people, and in a way it was a reaction to Pauline Hanson being elected as well. It was a statement in many ways, while being in support of the Black Americans campaign where, you know, Afro-Americans are being killed. But it's good to get your perspective, and thank you very much.
Thank you
so much for having me. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.